Welcome to Ritual of Practice Podcast. I am your host, Angela Houghton. The intention of this podcast is to inspire your practice. I thought it would be fun to offer stories of how different people integrate practice in their lives. I am so appreciative of the humans that share their experience on this podcast, and to you, listener, for joining us. May you show up for what lights you up. Hi, Angela here on Ritual of Practice Podcast. I'm in the studio today with Tommy Meyer. Tommy lives in Castle Valley, Utah, which is a tiny village outside of Moab, Utah, where he has a growing reputation as being a sourdough magician. So he didn't necessarily seek out the practice of baking sourdough. He was, you'll hear in our conversation, led to it. So the grace of him becoming a sourdough baker and now passing on what he has learned and played with to many others that I imagine will then continue to be a domino experience of those folks sharing it with others. So I think you're going to enjoy. There's lots of good nuggets getting down to the grain here in this conversation and the play, the practice and play of baking sourdough. Thank you so much for listening. Hi, welcome to Ritual of Practice Podcast. I'm here in the studio today with Tommy Meyer. Tommy makes, he bakes sourdough for Castle Valley Farms. And I learned about him because I shared with my writing group that I was really looking for some men to interview. And I don't even know how, we love food in our writing group. And I don't think we were talking about sourdough. Oh, actually, I do think we were. I think my friend Anne said, what about the baker for Castle Valley Farms? And everyone just was in agreement. They're like, that bread is magic. I forget the specific words that they used, but I definitely was like, ooh. And I bake sourdough myself and have been for years. And so I thought that'd be really fun. So yeah, thanks, Tommy, for coming in today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We do have one of Tommy's dogs with us in the studio who has found a Yamina ball to play with here. So if you hear some sounds in the background, it's Sadie finding fun in my office. So I think she's going to sit down and meditate now. And I'm going to ask Tommy the first question, which is, what initially sparked your interest in sourdough?
I have actually wanted to, I have wanted to learn the process for quite a while. And I grew up with a mom who was a baker. Her mom was French, and so she was constantly dragging my brother and I into the kitchen and show us how to make pies and all the things she was baking. Bread was not one of the items that she baked a lot of. We tended to buy a lot of bread, you know? So it kind of just came to me. I didn't necessarily say, okay, I'm going to learn it this week. A girl had come by the campus out there in Castle Valley a number of years ago and taught me how to make a gluten-free bread out of millet and flax. And that was a really good bread. And I ended up making like five different flavors, cinnamon raisin, you know, rosemary, olive, tomato, basil, and kind of had gotten to an end with that bread. Like it was just real repetitive, super simple, not a lot of artistic value. You know, at the end, it was just like, okay, do another batch every week. It was just, you know, and so then a year and a half after starting the gluten-free bread, a young guy came by. He was only 22 years old. I'm 40, almost 48. And he had this little Bannetton and he's in the kitchen over there. Like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm making a loaf of sourdough. I was like, oh man, I always wanted to learn that. Would you show me that? And he's like, totally. And this kid was an artist and he'd done it for, at that point, he'd been doing it for 7 years. He was 22. So
who did he learn from?
You know, I can't remember who he had learned from. But he was from Washington. His parents own a summer camp. And so he had just really gotten this down. I mean, he was a pro and he was just doing one loaf at a time. Like, oh, this dude, six, you know. And then I brought him to Moonflower. Hey, you want to buy these? Yeah, we'll buy these. And he was there for just a few months. And in those few months, we baked about 100 loaves together, was my training. And in watching some other videos, I remember seeing this one guy. He's like, yeah, don't even go and offer your services at a bakery unless you've baked at least 100 loaves. It's kind of, you know, and talking to my aunt, it took her a year, 2 loaves a week, basically, to, you know, bake 100 loaves. And she said that's when she finally, at a year, is when she finally felt like she, okay, I got this, you know.
That is actually so refreshing to hear, because when I first started dabbling in sourdough, I mean, it was all fails. And then, you know, I gave up multiple times, and then I'd get inspired or re-inspired.
Yeah.
I'd try again. And then, you know, often had to get another starter or make another starter. And then it was, yeah, it was probably in the last couple of years where I've been more consistent. Mm-hmm. And finally, yeah, my bread. So I wonder if I'm at 100 loaves. I've made it to that point.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like I'm a lot more consistent these days with the practice.
Yeah. Yeah, because all of a sudden, you know, he was there for just those couple of months in the summer, and then he left. And it was like the orders were on, you know, Moonflower was buying, you know, 20 loaves, 24 loaves of bread a week. And all of a sudden, I had to do it all by myself. And I hadn't yet, actually. He was just a master, you know, so I'd be playing around with a couple of loaves, and he'd be doing the majority of it.
Wow.
And it was a lot of watching. And so then, like, you know, once I took it on, my loaves, they went from these nice fluffy loaves to these little pancakes for a couple of weeks. And he sent me some videos, and I went back through, and I learned the lesson of riding the wave of the yeast.
Ooh.
So the starter, which he gave me, you know, I never went through this 2 week process of making my own starter. I started, here you go. I was just like,
it really helps to have someone else give you a starter, I've learned. Yeah.
And his was really, it's worked. I've baked pretty much every week, taking only a week off here and there. And typically we'll have somebody feed it that for that week. You know, I keep it in the fridge, feed it once a week. But I've kept it going since he taught me this, you know, almost 3 years ago now. I think this summer's coming up on 3 years. And it was a process that is all about timing. And so riding this wave, you know, it's like I realized, okay, the yeast rises and falls every 12 hours. Like, if you just leave it at room temperature, you feed it, it'll peak, and then it'll fall back down at 12 hours. So it peaks at 6. So I always feed my starter, and then I incorporate it into the dough starting in the fifth hour. So it takes me an hour, hour and a half to get all my batches together. So from that fifth through the sixth hour, I'm feeding my starter into the dough, and it's at its peak. And now it's into a whole another bit of dough, and it's like, and it's taking off again, you know, and it's, you're riding that, and then you're putting it in the fridge. I spread it out over 3 days. He taught me a 2-day process, and I've since spread it out over 3 days so I can do more. So I make a bunch of dough, put it in the fridge, bring it back out. You know, I do the stretch and fold that first day, put it in the fridge. Second day, pull it out, shape it into the bannetons, shape it into English muffins, back into the fridge. And that second night in the fridge, I put it into a proofer, and I watch the time and what it's doing and the temperature. And I'm trying to get just that dialed into where it's rising. But then when I put it in the fridge, it slows it down so it doesn't peak in the fridge, because you don't want it to peak in the fridge. You want it to peak in the Dutch oven. So you're riding the wave. It's just before the wave's breaking that you want to put the loaf into the Dutch oven and get it to do its last thing, you know. So it's heating up, and that last bit of yeast is like, and that's what's making the thing really spring, along with all your tension that you've added to it, you know. So it's just been so much more of a challenge than it was, you know, baking that gluten-free bread. It's just really inspired me to just keep going and you know, play around with it in other ways. You know, like, we've made pizza dough with it, and make these cinnamon rolls with it.
Oh yeah, I bought those. Yum.
And that's all the same thing. Like, that dough for the cinnamon rolls is a 2-day process. Like, we make the dough today, we'll make the cinnamon rolls tomorrow, kind of a thing, you know?
So putting it in the fridge, because I started doing that just to balance life. You know, I was like, whew, I can't fit this all into a day.
Totally.
So I just naturally started doing that. But my Brad lately has, the last two times, because I'm doing it every like week or two right now, it has been kind of the pancake flat. Yeah. And so I must be missing that peak, the timing of the rise.
Typically people tend to overproof it. They go, oh, there it is. It's perfectly doubled or whatever, you know, now bake it. You want to, you know, bake it more at the 1.5 time. It not quite getting to the doubling.
That's super
rise
helpful.
Just yet. Yeah, it really was helpful. I learned that from a video. This friend of mine sent me some baker in Washington, had this crazy huge bakery, and he had started out and wanted to do everything just by hand. I'm going to do it all by hand, make the dough by hand, you know, this is an artisan thing, and then realized can't do that, you know, and ended up getting huge mixers and, you know, tools that can really help. And so, yeah, an oven is the other really kind of key factor. So we've just ordered an oven, and so we're right in between stages now, going to be able to double what we can do in the same amount of time and not do a bunch of touch and touch. I don't know, do you cook in Dutch ovens? Is that how you do it?
I've mixed it up. I have done that before. Currently, I'm baking on just a stone, like a pizza stone sort of. Okay.
And you put some sort of steam tray or something in there?
What I do is I throw just a small mason jar of water into the first 20 minutes. Uh-huh. So I open the oven quick. Throw a glass of water in, close it quick.
Steam that all up.
Steam it. And then I open it at 20 minutes to let, if there's any leftover steam, to let that out.
Yeah. That's a good method. I actually haven't done more than one loaf. I think there was one weekend I baked a loaf at home one time, but I still used a Dutch oven. I didn't even attempt doing it. Otherwise, my aunt who lives in Burlingame up by San Francisco, she put in she bought one of these French ovens that has the steam injector.
That's something
that
nice.
All the ovens over there are like that. They're artisan ovens with stone hearth, you know. Yeah. So that's the home baking oven. It's just a real baking oven. And so the one we ordered, actually, a guy from England, it's called the, I want to say the Rackmaster, but there might be some other sort of something. It might be another brand. But anyway, the Rackmaster 2020. It's three shelves. You can fit six loaves in there. It's a stone hearth. The door seals, so it's ventless. You don't need to put it under a hood. You can use it in your kitchen. You know, it's a micro bakery, you know, oven for $8,000.
Did you buy this for Castle Valley Farms or for your home?
Yeah. No, for Castle Valley Farms, because the two ovens that we have are convection, and I have to use Dutch ovens, and I can't do any sort of steam tray or nothing. So it's a lot of handwork. I can only fit three Dutch ovens in the bottom tray at once. And then when those loaves come out, they come on the rack above and I can put three more in. So at any given time, I can bake six loaves at once in one oven. So I'm taking up two ovens to bake 12 loaves of bread, you know, and this oven will do 18 loaves of bread in a half hour. And you just load it up, shut the door. It's airtight. It steams in 20 minutes. You open the door, let the steam out, close it, and it finishes off. So super simple.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. I'm glad I learned the more difficult way, you know, whatever. I don't mind. I've kind of enjoyed the workout of it, actually, you know.
Right.
Like, I watched that documentary on Netflix called Live to 100 or whatever.
Did you see that? Actually, I was just talking with someone. Just talking with someone about this morning, and how that guy is really, because I was talking about sourdough and being excited to talk with you today. And she brought up that guy's name about the Blue Zones and that there's this big push. He's actually trying to educate Americans on how just the health of sourdough. It's pretty much all I eat now as far as bread.
Yeah, me too.
The challenge, though, is I eat it till it's gone. You know, like, so I bake it and then I eat it till it's gone. And then I take a little break and then I bake. I always bake two loaves with my recipe that I use. And so I've been eating one and giving one away, which has been working well recently.
Yeah.
I thought of a couple questions while you were sharing. One was, are you still using the recipe that do you remember the fella's name, the 22-year-old? I saw the look on his face, listeners.
I haven't thought of him for a while. Nathan,
we'll put it in the show notes. Fun to credit, like, because that's kind of a fun part of the story.
Yeah.
So, are you still using Nathan's recipe?
So, pretty much. I've actually upped the whole grain. What he taught me was whole grain brings all the flavor. So if you want it to have a lot of flavor, use as many different types of whole grain as you can even.
Wow.
And so that's why I just kind of always mix in there, you know, rye, spelt, along with whole wheat, and then einkorn, which, you know, until coming to this, really didn't realize the situation with wheat, you know, like seeing on their little package, that einkorn that they sell over there at Moonflower says that this is the last unhybridized wheat.
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
It's pretty messed up. And I started looking into, there's only a handful of wheats. There was hundreds and hundreds of varieties growing naturally all over the plains here, you know, and people are just gathering it and whatever, but it's been whittled down to a few. And then sprayed with a bunch of poison, all our grains sprayed with a bunch of poison on harvest. Yes. So I think a lot of issues that people are having thinking they're gluten-free is they're just eating a lot of poison. Mm-hmm. And that poison, as glyphosate is a broad spectrum antibiotic. So it just basically says everybody's on antibiotics. If you're eating regular store-bought crackers, store-bought regular bread, you know what I mean? It's not organic and it's, you know, sure, she could have the non-GMO stamp on there, but still they're drying the crops with glyphosate to get them harvested into the market quicker. So that's the poison of our food right there. And that, you know, I've been for a while, like, yeah, I had a friend who he and his wife, they only grow and eat their own food. That's it. And I'm just like, wow, that's intense.
That was the word that came to mind, intense. That is intense.
Yeah, and they moved and bought a property and start and, you know, grow enough food to not only feed themselves, but go to market and sell a bunch too. You know, they're really good.
In California?
They're actually in on the border in Indiana. In Kentucky. Nice. It's like a Louisville, you know, type farmers markets and stuff. And yeah.
I grew up, in a farming community, and my stepdad, grew acres of wheat and corn and alfalfa and soybeans.
Cool.
And I definitely, as I learned more, you know, in college and I remember this moment where I was like, oh, I have to educate my family. And my stepdad, he was a very intelligent man, and he'd went to college and studied agriculture, and he did try one patch of organic farming over the years, and it was a big failure. And so that was like the experiment, and it didn't work. But I remember all the, you know, the farm magazines that he would get that were just filled with ads for the pesticides. Like, they weren't, of course, the way that they were, it was more to protect your investment, you know, like, because that's the livelihood. And so
perfect fields pictures that just look great.
But all the chemicals, I remember as I grew in awareness and then being home when they were spraying the fields, I just almost felt like this panic inside from multiple, you know, perspectives. I do feel like I see it a little different now, because like I think I can understand and appreciate the tough place that farmers are in as they're trying to, you know, have a crop that yields, you know, that they can make money from. And so, you know, the genetically modified seeds, you know, just having more confidence, and there's, you know, like looking at the research and such, and then, you know, wanting to not have the bugs eat all their corn or whatever, you know, the crop is, like, I can appreciate it and have a lot of compassion. And go ahead.
Especially when it went from, you know, people with small farms to less people farming, and the farms getting so big that that's the only thing you could do. I mean, there's no way you're going to go out and deal with this, you know, by hand or even mechanically. You know, you've got to spray something. And we're backed into a corner, essentially.
Backed into a corner and just trying to find their way, just doing their best. Okay. And I think I recognized pretty quickly that my path wasn't to like try and educate my family like that. I was like, okay, let's just, and this has been like a reoccurring theme, like, let's just focus on myself and like continuing to educate myself. And instead of getting like really impassioned of like, it has to be this other way, just start to deepen my understanding and the choices that I'm making. It's been a slow journey. It's fun to hear. So these heritage grains, this is becoming so much like all the things that we're experiencing now. I feel like this return. So now there's, I feel, a growing curiosity. I actually bought some special flower the last time I was in Wisconsin. That's where I grew up. And it
Cool.
was, they had this whole wall essentially in this little tiny market of heritage grains that were grown really close to where I grew up. And I got excited because I was like, ooh,
Cool.
it is happening
Yeah.
in, over close to the communities where I grew up. And
Neat.
the this woman was in, or these grains are featured in this cook with this baking, this cookbook that I have, that this woman, she's in Arizona and they have a farm where they're now trying to bring back some of these ancient grains. And so it's fun to see, you know, it's a slow unfolding, but people start to get curious and start to try different things.
Yeah, have you heard of that guy? I want to say Paradis, or I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. It's like in Belgium, it's the world's only sourdough library.
No, but that sounds cool.
Okay, so yeah, you got to go look this up here. I can show you on your computer, but he has a virtual tour. You can tour it. You can go to this physical place and tour. He's got all these sourdoughs from all over the world. He started in like 96, I think, collecting sourdoughs. And then he would collect the grain as well from the local area because, you know, the bacteria and the yeast come on these grains. And so then to keep them alive so that he could study them. So he has a whole little profile, you know, he's just was really curious. Like, is it similar? Is it, you know, as unique as a fingerprint? Oh, yeah, I guess it is. I mean, it's like different profiles. Totally, you know, different grains, different places in the world, different yeast in the air, and just kind of studying it. And you can enter in your recipe and what you do and everything. And then each year they pick somebody who's entered all their stuff, and they ask you for some of your sourdough, and then your sourdough goes into their library, and they're building this library, you know.
How cool is
that? Yes,
it's
kind of cool. So I was actually just looking at that again after you called me, because I was just kind of wanting to revisit it, and I'm like, I need to enter in all my stuff here, and you know, on this list. A lot of the videos are in some other language, but it's cool. It's a really neat thing. Let's talk about grains for a minute. Like, it'd be great if we could grow them all ourselves. Obviously, they've grown wheat out there in the past, conventionally, so not you know, they're using sprays and stuff too. So. But for now, I originally was buying Lehigh Mills flour, the same one that Moonflower uses in their bakery. So
okay, I'm not familiar with it.
They were buying, you know, 50-pound sacks. I said, yeah, I'll buy some of those. So I started, you know, 2 50-pound sacks. I got the four, and then, you know. And then I met a really interesting lady in Castle Valley. She came by and she said, hey, are you making that bread over at Moonflower? And I said, yeah. She's like, do you need any help? I said, yeah. She's like, I just want to learn. She's like, I went to this school. It was a 2-day course, and I walked away with one loaf of bread. You know, I was taught how to make one loaf of sourdough bread, and it cost me $400. And I was like, wow, okay. Well, you just help me. I won't charge you anything, but you can just, you know, handle a bunch of loaves, you know, here. And she has gotten really good at it. And really good. She's like surpassed me in her shaping. Touches it more delicately or something than I was, you know. She's taught me some things now. It's kind of cool. But she introduced me to, so through that bakery, that it was in Petaluma, California. It's a research bakery for Central Milling up in Colleston. Are you familiar with them?
Not Petaluma, but not Colleston.
So Colleston, yeah, it's just up above, it's up by Logan's up there past Salt Lake. Right on their set of railroad tracks, huge silos. I mean, these guys are dealing grain, you know, and all organic.
That'd be so
I'm getting my wheat berries, my spelt berries, my rye berries from them organic. And then I buy what's called the ABC flour, which is the artisan baker's craft, which they worked for 5 years with this Petaluma bakery to develop that flour, that mix that's certain strains of wheat, and malt, and, you know, barley, and, you know, other things that they make that flour out of. And then they have an artisan baker's craft plus, which is, I think, just a little finer even for pastries and that sort of thing. And so they're really working, you know, with this Petaluma research place to like really develop these, you know, really high end flours for bakeries, basically.
How
So
exciting.
like, yeah, we just finally bought, we were buying, a dozen bags, and oh, buy, 20 bags. How much come on a pallet? Oh, 50 bags. Okay, let's get a pallet. So we just recently just got our first pallet of wheat and grain and flour and stuff from them. And when I switched from Lehigh Mills to theirs, I had to adjust the water. I mean, it totally changed. It got a lot softer. Just didn't need as much water, which was interesting. And so the bacteria, the yeast, yeah, they're coming on these grains. And once you kind of get the things, and feeding my starter those whole grains as well, because they say that the rye can make it real acidic, and can kind of do harm to your starter if you feed it a lot of rye. But he was feeding it rye when he gave it to me, and so I've just continued that, and it's super vibrant, and never given me any problems.
It feels like there's this whole, like it's a journey in itself.
It
And
is.
one of the questions I had from kind of going back before is, did you seek out Castle Valley Farms and baking for employment? Or like, what did that, how did this all get started? Take us
Yeah.
back to the beginning there.
So this is my ninth season out there, and originally my little brother was hired there, and that year, first year he was hired, they didn't have a math or science teacher. And I was a math and science major in college. I spent 1 year in the Marshall Islands as a volunteer teacher at a school out there, and taught math and science, and realized this is a huge responsibility. I don't want to be the teacher. Like, I thought this would be cool, but this is way too much. You know what I mean? Like, it was like you had to have something to say, you had to have this all prepared. I mean, every day, you had to grade all these papers. Like, what? It just all of a sudden was like, I'd rather be the student. And so I came back from that experience and did not pursue a teaching career any longer, but I still finished my science major in biophysics. And so my little brother said, hey, if you call my older brother, maybe he would come. And so the president called me and asked if I'd come teach math and science. I was like, well, I'm not really a math and science teacher. I have 1 year of volunteer teaching under my belt. And he's like, oh, that's fine. That's fine. We're a real small school, and we don't want to overwhelm the kids with academics. It's an outdoor program. We spend, 4 hours a day out on the farm, working outside. I was like, all right. And so those first few years, I was just in the classroom, and had been apprenticing with a farmer and had been doing quite a bit of just home gardening. And so kept spending time on the farm, and eventually, like, hey, yeah, more people came, and hey, you guys got those classes? I'll be over here on the farm. And so then I just ended up more on the farm. And then farm managers came and went, and all of a sudden everybody left one season, and it was just like, okay, hot potato. And so I was the farm manager season before last, and that's a heavy responsibility as well, which I wasn't totally ready for. But I'd watched a number of seasons go by, so it went all right. But the bakery thing, all the baking just kind of just came, like the, Brianna came and showed us the gluten-free bread, and I thought maybe the calf lady would, Rosalie would pick it up. Hey, you bake the bread. No, I don't want to bake the bread. Okay, I'll do it. And then, sourdough guy came, and oh, learn that. And so then it just, yeah. So now I teach a class, actually, in life skills class in baking, and so I get three students helping me each week, and that's how we've been able to get as much done as we've gotten done, is having all those extra hands. Skilled labor, and they love
So
it. They love it. Yeah.
experiential learning.
Yeah.
Have you taught anyone besides the woman who took the class in Petaluma? Is she still with you?
She is. Yeah. She's her, and she's dragged her husband into it.
Did
Oh,
she
no.
teach her husband or did you teach her
Totally. No,
husband?
she taught him. All of a sudden he was there, and I was like, cool. And she just taught him. And he's taught us some things. Like, we were being really light with it when we do the last stretch and fold before it goes in the banneton, and he just mashes it out. And we've done this thing where we've labeled it all the bannetons. We can't tell the difference. Yeah.
That's what's been really fun for me is to see how forgiving it is because of all my failures in the beginning. I was like, this is hard. It's so sensitive. And then recently I've learned at how not sensitive it is and
Yeah, it's
how,
timing. It's
yeah.
timing. It's like you can, you know, as long as you're not tearing it. If you're seeing the dough tear, then you're tearing the rubber bands. Because the second you hydrate the wheat flour, gluten strands start to form, and then they form these big long strands like rubber bands. And so all that stretching and folding in the beginning, that stretching and folding you do in the Banneton before you bake it, is all about building tension in the rubber band, but not breaking it. So that all that tension's there in the skin, you know, you've wrapped this whole thing up, and then you do your the cutting that you're doing is not just to be artistic. It's completely functional. You know, you have to do a baker's ear relief cut so that that can open up. You know, if you've ever tried to just bake a loaf with no cuts on it, it just pops and cracks and, you know, goes out the weakest corner, you know. So it wants to expand in that way. And that's what's just, I think, made the whole process even more fun, is just sitting there with a scalpel and just trying to, you know, play around with as many designs as you can and carve people's names and whatever, you know, play with stencils. We have a stencil set that we played with at times, and, you know, that just keeps you coming back, and kind of helps with the repetitiveness of it, where you're just doing this thing over and over again every week, you know, the same. Okay, we're gonna do 42 loaves of bread and 380 English muffins, and you know,
Is it the same kids coming back to learn, or do you get new kids?
every quarter it changes. Yeah, so I had three girls this last quarter, and they started the bakery journal. That was cute. So
Oh.
they were writing in there and stuff, and they were saying how this was their favorite class, and yeah, they had a good time. So, and they, you know, touch the dough, and I mean, I make them do it, you know, and that's been a real lesson for me. It's hard to relinquish, you know, because we're selling these things. It's hard to relinquish kind of control. You know, that's gonna flop. I can see it's gonna flop what you're doing there. But they have to learn too. You know, it's only in falling down that you learn how to fall more gracefully and then not fall as much.
Beautifully said.
You know?
So true.
Yeah. So I learned that from skateboarding. You know, it's just like falling down a lot on a skateboard, and learned how to fall more gracefully. You know, it's a lot better to tuck and roll than to just splat and slide. You know, and so same thing with this bread. It's you know, okay, let them experience it, let them see you know what happens when they do this, that, and the other, and to just be meticulous. It's a science, you know. I mean, we're weighing it down with a gram, you know, like it's not just do, you know, whatever. Pay attention to what you're doing, because what you just mixed together was 15 loaves of bread, and if you messed up the salt, then you know.
I've done
I know, we have too.
So you just mentioned skateboarding, and so I have had this thought. I usually try to ask a question. The essence is, has your practice here that we're talking about sourdough infiltrated another aspect of your life and how you approach it? Like, is there something else in your life that this journey of baking sourdough has informed?
Yeah, the timing thing, you know, has just made me more aware of the timing of other things, you know. I mean, that's surfing too. You know, I go surfing. It's like you just go up to the beach. It's not always the best time, you know. And there's that time. Hey, I heard about a storm coming. Then looking at it and perceiving that something's maybe gonna hit, you know, and then being there at the right time. But I wanted to back up just to your last question. I didn't answer. You asked if I taught anyone else, and there was another lady friend. Her and her husband came from Grand Junction, and they'd had a baby, and so she was home a lot. She's like, I want to learn this sourdough thing and take it to farmer's market. No one's selling sourdough at farmer's market. I said, all right. So she got a 3-day course. They came and camped in the parking lot in their camper, and she came every day in there, and her kid was crawling around on the floor, and my God, the health inspector doesn't come today. And we're making bread, and she learned it and went home, and in a couple of weeks got a handle on it
Whoa.
and was selling English muffins and sourdough loaves and selling out at the farmer's market. And she trimmed, like, we do an 800-gram loaf, you know, she was making like a 600-gram loaf and selling it for like $15, and selling and everybody and the news came and did this story on her, all this stuff, you know. And yeah, she's that was kind of an inspiring story that someone else just took it and ran with it like that, you know, because Gia and I is Gia is the one that comes and helps from Castle Valley. We talk about this a lot, you know, just the need for real food and the process, like learning this process has just been like the slogan for that library is the future of bread is found in the past, you know, and yeah, we threw away like all this past in 1941. Like the military, thanks, military industrial complex. We need to make this bread a little quicker, ladies. You know, this is taking way too long. We need to get this process done in a couple hours, you know. Rapid dry yeast, you know. I mean, that's where it came from.
Well, fun that we get to be the generation, though, that is part of bringing all of us back. Like, I mean, I grew up Hamburger Helper and sorry,
I
Mom,
know,
calling
right?
out.
I know. I know.
But I mean, everyone's just doing their best, you know, like all of a sudden, I feel like our parents' generation, they were juggling managing the home and then also managing careers. And so, yeah, that whole Industrial Revolution piece. And now I feel like we're trying to find creative ways and, you know, looking to the past of what worked well and revisiting that, not just in this way, but native, you know, native practices is coming up a lot on the podcast. You know, yeah, all the ways, all the things we can learn from the past.
Yeah, food's been a big part of my life, and so I often have told people learning how to make sourdough bread has been, I think, paramount, has been the pinnacle of my culinary education to this point. You know, it's really something so fundamental, but yet so profound and so ch life changing. You know, because you're eating a real food that is so similar to the way man had been eating it forever. Like, oh, let me put some grind up this grain, put it in some water. Oh, look, in a couple of days it's bubbling. Oh, look, just playing around with water and flour,
Yes,
you know,
it's awful.
and having no idea really what's happening there, but just seeing that something's happening because it's bubbling away and it smells good. You know, there's a difference between, you know, something rotting and something fermenting properly, like, you know, sauerkraut, that just fresh smell of fermenting sauerkraut. I mean, that's, you know, Lactobacillus plantarum, you know, going to town on the cabbage and creating all this lactic acid and increasing the vitamin C. That's why they didn't get scurvy on the ships, you know, is because if they had sauerkraut, yeah, it goes from 30 milligrams to like 600 milligrams in one little shred of cabbage.
Oh, I didn't know
The vitamin, so
that.
the vitamin C goes through the bacteria and the yeast and everything, you know, increase the level of vitamin C.
Awesome.
Yeah. And that's not the only thing. I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg, right? Of this whole thing that happens in these different older ways of preserving food that we just kind of lost because we got the fridge and we got rapid dry yeast and out the window, you know, and just put it in the fridge. Whereas before, you had to think about how are you going to store this and how are you going to, what amount of salt basically are you going to put in here to encourage the beneficial bacteria to grow and keep the spoiling ones out? I mean, that's essentially the science of it, right? So, yeah.
It's
Did you do
magic.
sauerkraut? Did you do sauerkraut and all that stuff too?
I do not, but I have read about
Oh,
the
nice.
benefits,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I do have, yeah, I do enjoy other fermented items, and I do feel like it makes me feel good in my stomach, so I'm good. I
Yeah.
was thinking, when I was listening to you, where do you see yourself going with this now? So, I mean, I love, you know, here in this moment and hearing how it is in all the lives you're touching essentially by sharing this to the people who are eating it, the people you're teaching, and then those people are, I imagine, going to teach other people. So it's like a domino effect in
Yeah,
my
totally.
mind. Are you still baking pies and other things, or?
It's I haven't been we, in the season we bake pie, you know, we do a bunch of apple pies, pumpkin pies,
And the fruits, right?
and the fruits there and everything. We do a lot of seasonal type stuff like that. But the bread has just been a real consistent thing through the year, you know, through all seasons. And that's been kind of interesting to see how it is different in the summer than it is in the winter. You know, your temperatures are everything, you know. And where I see it going, I see definitely the farm getting a hold of a food truck here at some point. Because we've built up a plethora of things. Like we'll go to farmers market and we do a Castle Valley carrot hot dog. I don't know if you heard of
I've
that.
eaten it.
So there's that, and there's, you know, a lot of other things we've been playing with in the cafeteria. I think if we had a little food truck, and with all the potatoes we're growing, we'd have food truck just everything potatoes, you know, it's all about potatoes. We just recently started experimenting with freeze drying purple potatoes, making a flour, and then incorporating that into the bread and making a potato bread. And it makes a real fluffy, like, it's really interesting.
Is
Yeah.
that can does that kind of like nod to your German roots? Like potato bread makes me think of
You know, yeah, maybe. You know,
Oh,
I never grew up eating potato bread or anything, you know, but because we had all these potatoes and we had freeze dried some purple potatoes as a mashed potato, and had it in a Ziploc bag, and we were like, what if we made hot dog buns with, we went to an event in Texas, and what if we make the hot dog buns out of purple potato flour, you know? And so we looked up this recipe and they turned out really good. I mean, those buns went first. I mean, I think we only went there with 150 buns or something, you know, like that. Those were gone, and then it was the whole wheat. And but
color in food is so fun, you
yeah, made them
know?
blue. Yeah,
Yeah.
it was neat.
And I think we're naturally drawn to that. Like there is like kind of a draw, a call to that, but it hasn't been a big part of, you know, the recent past, the
Oh
colorful
man.
food.
Yeah, there's more anthocyanins in the purple potato than there is in blueberries by pound.
Ooh,
So
I love all these fun facts.
and you're lowering your blood sugar eating a purple potato versus it going up, you know. And like that's the one that grows the most vigorously here. Like all the others, like even if we don't do the watering just right and everything, they kind of fail, you know. The purple one just does so well. And any purple food. I remember reading an article. This lady did all these tests comparing the purple variety against the green and yellow varieties of the same food, corn, you know, whatever, and found that all the purple varieties were higher in nutrient value, obviously. It just, you can see it, right? I mean, there's a color codedness to our food, and we're drawn to that. Yeah.
Oh, this is so fun. I love, food has been an interesting journey for me. I love food and I love baking. And I love eating good food, but I found it challenging to cook for myself and my family. And so, it's been, it feels like a very slow journey, but I'm just, trying to embrace what does work well, and baking sourdough is working well for me at the moment.
Yeah, cool. Very good.
I have one last question for
Okay.
you. What are you currently reading?
Well, I've read a couple of books pertaining to farming recently. I'm actually into the second one now by a Japanese guy. I think he died in the late 80s, maybe early 90s, named Masanobu Fukuoka. And he wrote The One Straw Revolution. Have you ever heard of that book?
No.
So that's his most famous one, and that's the one I read that book a few times. I had heard about it a long time ago, and then another guy mentioned it to me, and I said, I gotta get that book. And I listened to it, and then I bought it, and so I listened to it, read it, and it's just about his journey to natural farming, from being a scientist. You know, he was graduate, a college graduate, was inspecting plants for pathogens coming and going from Japan, and eventually became this natural farmer who just did everything really nat learned how to grow rice, dry land farming rice, you know, and said that when he figured that out, he must have felt like Columbus did finding the new world. I mean, you know what I mean? Like monumental things in farming, you know, you think, oh, rice, I've never really grown rice. But there's so much practical knowledge in the book itself. And like his famous quote in there is, the purpose of farming is not the growing of crops, but the cultivation and the perfection of human beings. You know what I mean? I'm like, whoa, man, this guy's like hitting on like the point of it. I mean, I really believe, you know, like it says in the Bible, you know, God put man in the garden, and he gave him a task, and that task was to dress and to keep. Doesn't really translate well. It's more to serve and preserve is the better translation of the original Hebrew. Serve and preserve the garden, because it's going to serve and preserve you.
Yes.
Like, we have this connection with the things growing around us. We're essentially made of dirt, and the plants take up the dirt and give it in a piece of fruit that we can digest. That, you know, it's just this regenerative process that's like, wow. And when you enter into the growing of the food, I mean, we're so separated from the farming aspect in our culture. You know, I watch my parents do one garden and it fail, and they never did it again. Like how yours attempted the organic and didn't, you know, failed. Mine just attempted a garden and just out the window, you know. So I didn't grow up around that at all, and really have grown a love for it, because there's so much failure there.
Yes.
That teaches you so much.
Yes.
I mean, you just, the more you add to it, the more failure you get to experience. You know, it's like, oh boy, whew, you know, and it's really, it's in those hardships and in those failures, and you learn resiliency. You learn how to do this better,
mm-hmm.
you know, and be more graceful in it. And yeah, and it's like, wow, it's changing you. It's making me a softer person. I mean, I'm a dad. I got two daughters, you know. My dad was a harsh guy, you know. He was real harsh, you know, verbally, like not so much physically. His dad was physically harsh. German. I mean, just, you know, you're mouthing off, crack. I mean, and you know, it turned into a more of a verbal thing. And so I fight that and realize that, yeah, I need to be calm. I need to, you know, I got two daughters, you know, and they're delicate, you know.
Also strong, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, they're strong. But just trying to match that strength with, you know, do this like this, you know, isn't gonna help. There's that nurturing and just allowing them to learn and fail. So yeah, so that book just really has really spoken to me lately, The One Star Revolution. And then he wrote another one. He came over here to the Southwest actually and wrote another book called Sowing Seeds of the Desert.
Ooh. I want to check out both of those.
Just,
but that's
just
like
a little bit into it, and it's just like, wow, this is, yeah, he's just really, really interesting. And I definitely see the more the importance and why really I felt like you know, God led my family and I out here. That's why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Tommy, this, like, I'm so tickled. Like, this is feels, yeah, I love when things just flow and feel so connected, really, you know. Like, it was easy to, well, actually, no, it wasn't. It was hard to reach out to you. I was a little nervous.
Oh.
I was like, I don't know if he's going to say yes. And then I was like, well, it's okay if he says no. And then you're like, yeah, let's do it. And, you know, so for the listener, we just met this morning and Tommy's at my house, you know, which also kind of, you know, I feel a little exposed and, you know, because we just met and such, and it's my personal space. And I just feel like my heart having this conversation with you feels expanded, and you know, I feel connected to you and excited about food and excited about sharing this with, you know, my family and the listeners. I'm really excited. Thank you so much for being here.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the conversation that Tommy and I had today about sourdough. A couple of things. Do check the show notes if you want resources or you're curious about what he shared regarding the books and the different granaries. So we'll have all that in the show notes, and then the link also to the sourdough library in Belgium. And then just a few takeaways that I wanted to share. So I loved that he said it's the experiment or the play that keeps you coming back. I think that really applies to all things. And then learning how to fall gracefully. Another is what failure teaches us. And this is such the nature of practice and how that changes us on the journey when we kind of surrender to and are open to what failure has to offer us. And then a quote from the Bible that he shared his interpretation of, which is to serve and preserve the garden because it is going to serve and preserve you. I thought that was really beautiful. Thanks again for listening. If you liked this episode, please share it with someone you love. Thank you for tuning in to the Ritual of Practice podcast. You can find the show home at ritualofpractice.com. Follow us on your favorite listening platform to receive weekly inspiration for your practices. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone you love. Until next time, keep practicing.